You're listening to the Builderpedia podcast, the only podcast that takes you on the whole property journey, from planning, design, building, selling, and everything in between. Along the way, we'll introduce you to our network of friends and colleagues who are experts in their field. Now, here are your hosts, Matt and Jeannie from Ballast Point.
Welcome back to another episode of Buildapedia. This is episode 4 on how to cut down on building costs. Hi, Matt. How are you doing?
Hi, Jeannie. How are you? Big question is, how did your submission go? You had a big submission this week.
I did. I spent 2 weeks working on, just basically finalizing the design and submitting it. And it was a lot of work. It was the final studio. And to be honest, I'm a little burnt out, so I'm glad that it's over. it was good fun. But as always, it just becomes a bit of a grind towards the end. That's what I found. So I'm glad that it's done and submitted.
Well, I spent the weekend in Canberra, and it was so cold. The funny thing about Canberra is that it says 9 degrees, and you think that's okay. 9 degrees is okay. It can be 9 degrees in Sydney, but then you look closely, and there's a little, the little feels like thing on your
It's
9 degrees, feels like 0.9 degrees, and you're like, how is that possible? and you go out. And it feels like you're going to freeze, but that is brilliant.
What were you up to in Canberra?
Well, we went to just hang out with my wife and have some time out, and conveniently we brought mountain bikes with us. So,
oh, nice! You were out and about.
Bit of Canberra dining, which is exceptional, and bit of mountain biking We went to the gallery, but most of the gallery was closed. But they're rebuilding. But it was great to get out of the city, go somewhere different.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I feel a bit refreshed. So
So you had a little bit of a holiday, a bit of a break.
Got a bit of stuff done as well. That was good. It's good to do that every now and again. So what's on the agenda?
So in today's episode, we will be carrying on from the last episode, which is where we talked about the current inflationary period that we're in, and we're seeing that building costs are rising, and talking a little bit about how we're seeing that translate into our business and our clients. We also talked a little bit about fixed versus cost plus contract, and the fact that at this stage, banks will only be accepting lump sum contracts. So in this episode, with all those factors, we are going to be empowering our listeners and our clients to think about what they can do proactively in order to keep building costs down on their projects. So before we jump into the meat of the episode, though, I was interested to know, Matt, this week, who has inspired you?
So this week, reading a book. I should have remembered the author's name, but it's called Originals. I'll look it up in a sec. But what inspired me is a story from that book of Sergio Popovich, who was a student activist, and he's only intriguing is he's the only, maybe shows you how old I am, but he's only 2 years older than me, and yet he was one of the leaders of the Serbian Revolution that brought down Milosevic. And the interesting thing about the way, and by the way, I've realized that he's also featured in a few documentaries, and there's some great material about his story, and which I'm very keen to look into. But they didn't really, it was a non-violent revolution. They just kind of, it was a slow nudge revolution. Like that's how I would describe it. And they started doing things like, they started doing little things here and there, like dropping a lot of ping pong balls on the streets as a way of protesting. And things like that are very hard to pin on anyone or action. So, you know, Milosevic had all these police and cronies picking up these ping pong balls that were just always accumulating. And this was part of the comedy of the whole thing. They became a laughing stock.
Yeah.
As the people who were picking up ping pong balls. And, you know, they put colouring in fountains and it would be just little nudges that showed that, hey, there's more, we're all in this. There's a groundswell here. You're not alone in thinking, you know, this guy's an idiot and taking our country in the wrong direction. And of course, you know, that's a very one-dimensional recitation of that story, but there's a lot more to it. But I think he was incredibly intelligent and very ballsy as a student leader to take on the government. And one more little thing.
And I guess doing it in a non-violent way as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
From what you're saying, yeah.
Absolutely, but one of the intriguing things is that he was then showing, he became a go-to man for showing other leaders around the world how to use those sorts of tactics, putting up the odd poster here and there, or tagging a particular thing or doing those non-violent things. So he became a go-to for training other and non-violent activists around the world. So I felt that was that's definitely, you know, inspired me. There's a lot of learning from that. But who inspired you this week, Jeannie?
This week, two people inspired me. One is someone called Gabor Maté. He's a physician that is a thought leader on addiction, and also another guy called David Goggins, who used to be a U.S. Marine. And the value of these two people that have came across in my life is, I thought Gabor Maté's work on addiction was super interesting because in modern day, I feel like, well, in my life, I guess, because sometimes the things that you're doing is hard, and I guess I'm being quite open here, is that I feel like I have a tendency to eat to like self-comfort whilst I'm doing a lot of work, and it's become like a bit of an addiction. So and if it's me facing these issues, I feel like lots of people are dealing with this in the modern day. So I thought just learning about the mechanisms of addictive behavior and like not being mindful and feeling the need to self-soothe is something that I'm very focused on and I want to learn more about and become more self-aware about. No, that's okay. And I guess just to follow off that trajectory is learning about this guy called David Goggins. He used to be like super, super overweight. And then he like became really mentally strong by going into the US Marines. And he wrote a book called Can't Hurt Me, and I'm about to start reading that. And I guess like that's something that I want to learn from and get stronger. I think it's a mental thing. With daily life and making sure that you're doing all the things that you need to do and just making sure that you're mentally tough enough to stay on track kind of thing. So it's a constant process. And I think coming across different people and learning different outlooks and approaches can only help.
Yeah.
That was probably a bit more personal.
I think you're, eating is just a normal human reaction to every, I don't think anyone's immune from it. When eating is a comfort, it releases endorphins or whatever it does to make us feel better, and it's just a normal tendency. So it's not I think you're far from a food addict, Jeannie, but it happens to everyone. But I remember reading a book called Willpower by Roy Baumeister. And really, it's, you got to think of mental energy as like a resource. And when you're putting a lot of resource into other things, like your submission, like where when you're actually putting focus and working to focus on other things, then you have limited energy to control your willpower and other things. And so you got to think of it as a tank that you fill up, you know, that the willpower is a tank. It's more like it's definitely also a muscle you can train. But I mean, I remember this a story out from that book Willpower, where there's a guy who he does things like he stays in an ice box for weeks, being very uncomfortable. Oh, wow. And he's got world records for cold water swimming, I think, and just silly things like sitting in what seems to be a description of an oversized esky for a very long time, being very cold and coping mentally with that. And yet when he's finished those stunts or those performances, whichever way you want to categorize them, or those feats of endurance, his downtime, he definitely goes the other way and overeats and doesn't do much. Because he's put so much energy into that stunt. I'm not saying it right, calling it a stunt, but certainly there's a volume of energy that you have, and you can't do everything all at once. But your problem, don't worry, your problem is not unusual. it's a very human struggle. It's what everyone struggles with, some more than others. Food's an interesting one.
It's a phenomenon called the college pounds. People tend to put on weight when they go off to study, and
my own personal take is that it doesn't matter what happens at home is a foregone conclusion. The battle is at the checkout. It's what you get at the
totally
all the difference. You can't pretend that you're gonna bring ice cream home and not gonna eat a little bit. Like, you just forget about it. Just
I agree. Yeah, that's the conclusion I came to as well.
I think if you only do one thing, then shop at the right time, not when you're hungry. Shop when you're relaxed. Shop when you make good decisions, and that'll flow on down the track. But anyway, enough life advice. What are we here to talk about again?
All right. So now we're going to jump into the meat of our episode. The meat of our episode. the title is How to Cut Down on Building Costs. So in order to do this in a understandable and easy to follow fashion, the strategy we're going to follow today is that we're going to go through all the different steps of the building phase, starting from the design at the very beginning, moving on to getting your development application, then to construction documentation, and the final step of construction before you have the final product of your house. So each of those stages we're going to go through and break it down into different strategies, different tips and tricks that you need to think about in order to cut down on the building costs. So starting at the design phase, Matt, what can you say here?
So let me share a couple of anecdotes where I've been brought a design to look at as a licensed builder and share an opinion of, and I've looked at the design, and I'm kind of thinking, I think a little bit in, I mean, floor space, square meters of floor space isn't the only metric that's important, but I have looked at designs where really you're increasing the length of the building by a very marginal, in a very marginal way, maybe extending by a meter because that's all that's allowable by council conditions. And I kind of think, and what it involves normally is rebuilding the whole back of the building, demolishing a substantial amount, redoing the flooring and redoing the ceilings. Like, so, and I kind of go, why would you do that to gain a meter of space? And sometimes the space isn't really a problem. It's just where the where that particular client has ended up wanting more space and being pared back by council conditions. So, I guess fundamentally getting the pre-design process right and putting clear objectives in place is the most important thing. And it feels like, and it's something that you, as you know, Jeannie, it's something I've drilled into everyone in our practice, right down to make sure your objectives are on the front
Yeah,
cover
it's
of
everywhere
the
now.
document, because it's
Yeah.
easy to, one, it's easy to lose sight, but two, it's important to create a focus around, well, I didn't say that very well, but I think it's important to know what the objectives are so that you can meet them. And I'm look so looking at some designs that I've had brought to me, I'm kind of thinking, geez, for that extra 5 square meters of space, one, you're not getting hugely better space, but for those 5 square meters, you're spending like 25, 30 grand a square meter
Yeah.
to extend
Yeah.
your house just a little bit.
Yeah. So it's the cost versus value trade-off to
Yeah,
be really clear on what you're.
totally, totally.
Yeah.
But I guess fundamentally, getting the design right is the best return on investment, but also it's also where you can save the most money. Everything flows from there, whatever. So once you've designed it, once you've got a structural set of drawings, sure, you can still make cost saving decisions. You can still try and hire more cost effective staff or I guess subcontractors or tradesmen, but you kind of set the baseline cost, so you don't have anywhere to go from there in terms of baseline cost. You can find small cost savings, but they're very marginal in the scheme of things. So that getting that first design, you know, and it relates to realization of value and how much value is created per dollar spent. But if you're on a budget, that budget has to be one of your objectives. So if you're trying to contain your project within a budget, you have to be upfront with your designer and drill it into them, and don't be scared to say, that's my budget, that's all I'm spending. Do not design anything that exceeds that budget. And the thing that we always do is we most budgets fail because they don't have a contingency. So budgets always need a contingency. We put in 20% as a standard contingency. And you need that because there's always uncertainty. There's always movement. There's always things that change and things you don't expect when you take apart the old building that you find you have to deal with. But
Does that 20% contingency still apply now? Because last episode we mentioned how just from inflation, that before we get to construction, oftentimes the contingency has already been eaten up. So is that still the right amount at 20%?
look, I think it is, but you're still like what people found in the last year is that it has been taken up by price escalation. I don't think that level of price escalation will continue. In fact, for the first time in years, there's people phoning me saying, "Hey, I do waterproofing. Do you need any waterproofing?" There's still sectors of the workforce that are exceptionally busy. It's still very hard to get particular trades, carpenters, particularly bricklayers, but it's starting to soften a little bit. It's starting to get more and more emails from recruiters saying, "Hey, I've got a great site manager who does luxury residential." You're starting to see more. So it feels anecdotally, not, I don't have any data. I haven't reviewed any data, but it feels anecdotally like there is a bit of a softening.
Yeah.
So, and material.
Well, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because it can't always just be so extreme. So it will eventually ease off.
Yeah.
More likely than not, statistically, you know.
Yeah. And material prices have spiked in certain areas, but I feel like most of those spikes relate to labor. Like, so if you're getting flashings or something that involves a labor input, those prices have spiked. But and certainly the cost of energy is more, so energy intensive items are more expensive. But then when you walk down the aisle of Bunnings and look at general stock and general prices, it doesn't feel like they've hugely escalated. That, you know, energy inputs drive up prices, definitely, but you know, we don't know where energy prices are heading, but it feels like 20% is probably still appropriate, but maybe it should be a bit more. Maybe if you're it depends. If you're super tight and your budget is you're definitive, you want to set a budget, maybe put a bigger contingency because you will need it. So if you have a hard barrier to finance, if you want to set it hard in stone, maybe put 25% contingency and pare back the scope somewhat. But in terms of strategies, in terms of design strategies, because that's probably more the core issue, if you make the design simpler, it will be more cost effective. And one of my favorite things, as you may recall, Jeannie, in design reviews that we've done together, is asking questions like, what is the benefit of having three different roof planes when you could have one, and putting it back to the designer to say, "Hey, if it was one roof plane rather than three, where would you see that from, and who would know about it?" And sometimes when you look at it that way, actually no one, maybe the neighbor four houses down from their balcony, will see that it's one roof plane and not four. And just simple things like that, rationalizing the building.
I think, yeah, even as a student, like, this is a bit off topic, but I think as a student, as an architecture student, in my experience at uni, like, you're not always bound by a budget, or you're not always bound by practical reality. So I guess, like, the value in me listening in on design review and hearing you talk about rationalizing the building is that it brings a very, you know, feet on the ground reality assessment of what is a good design, and it helps me kind of learn about what actually is a value in the real world versus if it's just for aesthetics purposes or it's unnecessary. So I think, yeah, I think, like, just in terms of, like, future training, it helps, yeah, to simplify the design and make it easier in terms of the cost as well.
Maybe I should run a class at your uni around rationalizing buildings and cost constraints. That's certainly something that I guess many architects struggle with, and I think I think it's okay to have ambitious design, but I think it's understanding how a particular element contributes to the greatness of that design, and some things make so little difference. I mean, another example in terms of tweaking a design slightly is changing something that I've done on a number of projects where I've challenged the designer and I've challenged the owner to say, hey, you've got this amazing glass roof in your upstairs corridor, and what is its purpose? Its purpose is to bring light down the stairwell. And I just say, will anyone know if that's a custom roof window or a custom glass roof as opposed to a series of off-the-shelf skylights? How many people will walk through the house and actually notice that feature, particularly when it's, say, it's on an upper level in a corridor that leads to kids' bedrooms or spare bedrooms? And you kind of go, the benefit is of using a standard skylight is they're available off the shelf, they're cost effective, and not only that, but your roofer installs them all. So one entity puts the roof and the skylights in place. And
I guess leading off that point, what you're talking about is a more custom skylight versus a standard off the shelf option to cut down costs. I guess just coming off of that, would you say like modularizing the design or finding ways to, well, like simplify the build, but also to specify things that are much more accessible, is like a first port of call from the outset?
Yeah, let me throw a curveball into that one. So the ultimate optimization, modularization, is a project home, is a design that already exists from a builder who has economies of scale to deliver that design. So your Metricon or similar, although some of them are in trouble, but in the current market, for reasons we won't go into right here, but they're certainly have economies of scale. They build the same buildings over and over again. They know which parts to order, where to order them from. They get bulk discounts. They have reliable tradesmen who work or subcontractors who do all their work. And if you're on a budget, it's totally appropriate to reach out and see if that sort of solution fits onto your site and addresses your problems. And in fact, we've done that for a couple of clients where we've said, you've got a reasonable width on your site and you're not constrained by heritage or other constraints. Let's see if we can take a standard model off a production line and apply it here, because the cost saving's substantial. I mean, it's kind of half the price per square meter. And I do know this because occasionally we get clients coming to us who are downsizing and they look at the economics of renovating a small apartment in Birch Grove or somewhere in the inner west of Sydney and say, for that price, we can get a whole house built in the Sutherland Shire or somewhere. And you kind of say, well, it's a different economics. It's first of all, you've got to walk everything in because it's an apartment. So everything's handled differently, and the costs of compliances in a heritage conservation area are different, and everything's different. You know, you go from something that's compliant development to a development application, the costs ratchet up. So yeah, I always try and encourage people who come to us who I think have an appropriate site to find an off-the-shelf solution. But I kind of, the only thing about project homes, and I don't know if you've looked at any or you've studied any, but why do they have such ugly facades? I just kind of go, it's not incredibly bad. What makes it bad is the seven different finishes and textures that you're trying to apply to your facade, and like the fake stone column that's almost ubiquitous for a particular period. You kind of, why?
They certainly have a distinct look about them. Yeah,
you just kind of go, okay, it's not the worst design in the world, it's not architectural genius, but then why have you hit it with an ugly stick? Like, why do you think? And I don't know, maybe it's what people like, but I kind of go, look, if you just rationalized that a little bit and simplified it, made it cleaner, reduced the number of materials, it doesn't look too bad.
And might cost less.
might cost more because every time you diverge from that standard product, it's a modification, so it may cost a little bit more, but it might be worth it. So I always just want to simplify and rationalize
the facade. Yeah. I guess I meant if the standard was just a simple thing. And
absolutely. Yeah. I don't know, like, I don't know what it is. Why do they need to have so many?
I guess materials? It's subjective, and some people might like that look. I mean, if it sells, right? Explains why it's popular. I guess
that might be part, that might be part of the reason. You know, I like might not be what their typical. What their typical.
But that reminds me of talking about how will be built, like rationalizing the building. Another thing that probably needs to be thought about from the design phase is how the materials would get onto the site.
Yeah,
would affect what you would choose and the cost and the labor involved as well. I think that's a lesser talked about.
Absolutely. So
at the design phase,
two things, I guess. One, in my experience, is limit the number of materials. So if we are working on a project that's on a tight budget, it can't really have timber ceilings and feature concrete columns, and it's got to be simple. It's kind of got to be gibberock. If it's at a particular price point, it's got to be gibberock. Mm-hmm. What you do with that gibberock, though, you could, you know, there's limitless possibilities within reason. Changing the shape slightly or adjusting things doesn't make a huge difference to the cost, but it's hugely impactful. There's another point to be made, and it's very, very simple and obvious. Heavy materials cost more to move, particularly when when you've got limited access to a site. So the heavier the material, the more embodied energy in it, which is not an environmentally sound solution, but two, the more it'll cost, because the cost of energy is more, and three, the more it will cost because you have to expend more energy to move it. So you have to crane things in where otherwise you would just have carried them in, or you may carry things in which take a lot to carry bricks in, definitely more expensive than carrying timber. And a lot of brickwork has been... a lot of brickwork and blockwork has been superseded by other products that are lightweight but core filled, like Dinsel and the like, so that they've got better economics, because I guess pumping concrete's still economical, although concrete.
But it's not environmentally friendly.
Yeah, concrete's not environmentally friendly, but then, you know, if you're choosing between, I guess we're getting off topic, but between concrete blocks, which you have to expend a lot of energy and time manually moving, or lightweight dinsel, which is easy to move, and then you're core filling both of them, then the lighter material wins out. But, you know, it's got other downsides. But, yeah, so if you do one thing, reduce the number of materials, like refine it to essentials. And there's two things that happen there. One is you get better economy in terms of ordering. But the second thing that most people don't think about when designing or choosing materials is that for every additional trade that your builder has to place an order for, subcontract in, for every additional trade, there is extra time in the project, and there is extra cost for the builder to manage an extra contract. So if you've got five different finishes in one space in your house, if you've got a bit of concrete, off form concrete, and you've got a bit of brickwork, and you've got a bit of plywood, then you've got all these grades coming in separately, as opposed to one, you know, the more, and I'm not, would never suggest that, okay, don't do any of those. If that's what you need to do, you need to do, but just factor in for every additional material that you introduce. So if you introduce a feature stainless steel column that's clad in stainless sheet or aluminium or something, for every additional finish, you're not only are you expending cost for that finish, which might be expensive, but you're actually expending energy to hire that to engage that contractor that does that stainless or aluminium cladding. So and then your builder has to particularly when it's a non-standard product, your builder has to first connect to the right people, then bring them in, get a quote. It's a process, and that might be 20 hours. And I think builders have a knack for going, look at this project, there's a lot happening. That's a lot of work. So when they price your work, that certainly has a factor.
So to wrap up the design phase and the strategies to reduce costs here, I would say the biggest things that we've talked about is probably the cost versus value trade-off, in terms of the design itself, whether that extra meter of decking is worth it to move the back wall. Is it worth it to really think that through? And also to think about modularization and off-the-shelf options if you can, in order to simplify and rationalize the design. And lastly, also to think about how things would be built. So in terms of which materials and how it will get onto site, and whether there are more cost-effective or more environmentally friendly options as well. Those are things to be considered at the design stage.
And reducing the quantity of the variability and the quantity of different materials that
exactly
important. But I'll say one more little thing, and this comes from my experience of clients coming to me as a builder and having had a design done and having not getting much traction with builders taking an interest in their project. And the thing that there's various reasons, and they, you know, their designer might blame a busy market or, you know, not various environmental things, but sometimes I look at their drawing and I just go, it's the quality of the drawings.
Right. Yeah, right.
Quality of the documentation. You're showing this to a builder, they're not understanding the scope from your drawing. Sometimes, and at one extreme, you know, some people think that because they've got a DA set of drawings, they can just show that to a builder and get it built. Some builders can cope with that. But I guess myself as a builder probably wouldn't be happy, because I know that getting things documented well saves time when you're on site. But I think the quality of the documentation, like having a clear demolition plan, identifying clearly the scope, and there's an art to it.
Yeah.
And there's an art to
totally
a set of drawings.
And that's something I did not understand before I started studying architecture. Like, from the outside looking in, you're playing Lego, right? Like, you're building things and it's fun and you're creating beautiful things, but there's so much more to it in terms of communicating through drawings. And as you said, like, in my opinion, it probably just needs to be like dumb and easy, like really dumb to be able to just understand it off the bat.
It doesn't need to be dumb, it just needs to be I think that there's a skill involved in stepping outside of what you've just drawn and thinking, how would someone read this and interpret it? And is it clear? Yeah. Will it be clear? Because the problem is, you've designed it. Of course it's going to be clear in your head.
Yeah.
You totally get it. You don't understand. And it's very hard to understand why someone won't. So you really, it's all about seeking feedback. And kind of go, hey, does this make sense? And and I know from my experience that I've looked at drawings and I struggle to even name what it is sometimes. But quality designers, you look at drawings and you go, I know exactly what you're after. I know exactly what this project, and I can do that.
Yeah.
You know, I guess as an experienced builder, I can cut to the chase very quickly and get the scale and the quality and get the scope of the project within minutes sometimes. Other times I've gone from end to end in the drawings and just gone, what the fuck is going on? Like, what do they want? What is going on here? What do they want? I'm not getting it. The problem is, if a builder has to think and work at understanding what's on the drawing and what your scope is, their interest will wane quickly.
Yeah.
I want it to be simple. I think one hack is probably 3D putting 3D drawings in and clearly identifying on the 3D drawings
what
the scope is and what, how it changes. That's incredibly valuable, even for people who are incredibly experienced at reading drawings and building that, because that's how you look at drawings, you build a 3D model in your head.
Yeah.
But that's limited to what, distilling from what you've seen. It's definitely a powerful experience, even for a very experienced builder, to get a 3D drawing and understand and see it. There's something that you can't, there's always a gap between how you build it in your head and how you understand it, and then seeing it in 3D is always better. So 3D drawings are definitely better. But that's kind of a very important factor. And I said one more thing, but I went on a bit. You may want to edit it down.
But I think that's a really great point. It needs to be covered off at the design stage as well. Moving on next. So the next stage, after you've got a great set of drawings, you've got the design down, is probably you want to go to a cost estimator, someone who's experienced in the type of build that the design shows. And get a realistic kind of appraisal of what the total sum of the cost would be. And by doing that, you're able to have some wiggle room to refine things before it's locked in and you send it off to DA, and it's a bit more finalized that way. So can you cover off on if there's any strategies at this stage, key things to think about from a cost perspective?
I think I think there is and there isn't, and I'll tell you why. I think it's because most people think that a quantity surveyor has interpreted something, and so they might not have got the right brief or the right scope, or for some reason they don't get it. But the way to view and to think about a professional estimator or quantity surveyor is they're your truth. Say what? How do we put it? They're your sort of objective kind of
There you are, your
reality
hard
check.
knocks.
Yeah. So it's easy, and a lot of architects go will kind of start going, I don't think it's right. They've put too much money here and too much, you know. And you kind of go, yeah, but it's easy to see where they've added things, but it's very hard to find where they've under quoted things. It's very, you know, sometimes things that seem too expensive stick out, but you should. The fundamental thing about cost saving strategy and quantity surveyors is take their advice. Don't pretend that somehow you, even though they're telling you it's a $2 million build or a five, you know, whatever it is, that you're still going to do it for one and a half. You might, if you're really clever and you pull some things out and you adjust, and well, maybe, but don't kid yourself. Don't pretend that somehow you're going to shop around and find better value in windows and things, and you're going to get the price substantially down. Go with the advice. That's the whole point. Whereas I've seen that advice kind of be a little bit,
Like not taken
not
seriously.
to, well, not seriously, but maybe just not taken for what it's supposed to do, which is give you a reality check. It's kind of like, oh, okay, well, he said this, but I think that, you know. So I think that's, and I think we're going to chat more about building economics in an upcoming episode. But I think
Yeah, we
in
will.
terms of cost saving, they're your source. They're your mirror on the project, and just they're the only objective measure you get. Everyone else wants it to cost less. Your builder wants it to cost less than it actually does. The architect always wants it to cost less than it actually does.
And I guess it like I mean instead of kind of sticking your head in the sand, it's a good thing at this stage to like really assess what the cost estimator has given back to you, because it means you don't actually have to pay that number yet.
Yeah,
You still have a chance
absolutely.
to move things around. All right. So after the cost estimator stage, it would most likely your design will need to go to DA to develop to the development application stage where it is assessed by council. Is there anything that could be done here to save on costs, or maybe if it's a standard council rate, maybe to save costs in terms of time as well, how long things take to get processed?
So maybe two things there. One is understand what you're in for, and so I think we've had a few clients who've come to us, and some things you've had experience in getting approved. You can give them good advice, but some things that they're asking seem like they're going to be quite difficult, if not impossible. So the best thing to do is to actually, you know, before we design anything, before we start drawing, we bring a consultant in, and that might be a lawyer, a property, not a property lawyer, a planning lawyer, who can give you upfront advice quickly. And in some cases, we've done a quick assessment. We've done a sort of preliminary design consultation, and we've kind of said to the client, okay, there is a chance you're going to get this design through, but it fails on so many metrics that council look at, so many issues with it. It's it's impossible. You won't get it approved, so you'll have to go to court. And if you go to court, you might lose, and it'll cost you X amount.
Yeah. So this happens even before the design stage.
Oh yeah, yeah. Before you're drawing. So, as an example, we had a client a little while ago who wanted a third level extension. They've had a sort of pitched or pyramidal roof, and they wanted to extend up into it. And they were already maxed out in floor space ratio, which is the ratio of land, of floor space to land. So they were already well over. They're in a heritage conservation area. Council don't support generally third level extensions in the area. There was potential for obstructing views from
people. Yeah, so it was just pretty much like it's just not going to happen from the outset kind of thing.
Well, it could happen, but it'll be a battle. And it definitely wasn't something that particular client was keen on. They said, no, that's not what we want. Mm. That's so far outside of what we're intending as a process. We don't want to spend $100,000 that we might lose.
Yeah.
So that was a definite no, and we came up with a different solution for them, mm-hmm. that didn't involve, you know, it involved creating a veranda space and a more outdoor, more comfortable outdoor entertaining spaces that addressed their problem in a different way, but didn't result in a fight with council and neighbours.
Yeah.
So
I guess an asterisk, or, you know, air quotes thing to consider at this stage is probably, before anything, you're probably best to talk to a planning lawyer, you know, what you should expect from council as a response in terms of what you propose for the project.
So it depends, Jeannie. It depends. Like, you don't need to, if you've got a simple brief in mind, you don't need to go to a planning lawyer. But if you've got something that is outside of the norm, then, do your homework, essentially. Do your homework. Understand or hire someone to help you do that homework so that you know what you're up for.
So once you've got your DA application approved, you're at a really good spot and you're ready to go on to construction documentation, which some of the points I was covered before in terms of having really good and clear drawings detailing how your project is going to be built, and also outlining the types of materials you're going to use and making sure that you're simplifying both the design and also the types of materials that you're going to use as much as possible are key things to think about at this stage to cut down the cost. So at the final stage, this is the construction stage where we will start creating and building your project in real life. So in this stage, what do you need to think about to cut down the costs, Matt?
So now we're in construction, and one of the things that comes up is, well, which bit do I get the builder to do and which bit can I do myself? So I think my first bit of advice is don't fall into the trap where you're maybe earn a reasonable income, or you're a high income earner, and then you're paying yourself $5 an hour to paint your house. I think there's definitely value in doing some things, and the quality of the paint job, the quality of the whole product. So,
yeah.
And a friend of mine who I won't mention recently found that out by getting a really cheap painter choosing the lowest price and then finding the pitfalls of that, where they paint over all the window hardware, and like it's painted windows and you know, some of the paint started peeling off quickly. So there's definitely value in some things. So
paint jobs. So the paint job would be something to invest in a good quality tradesman to do that.
Let's finish some of the finishing things, particularly. That lift the building on if they're done well. Get good tradesmen. It's easy to sort of go, oh, I'll do that myself. But what you can do yourself is manage some of the sub trades if you have time and you want it and you're trying to save money. Well, get the shell built, get the house watertight and locked up.
Yeah.
So when it comes to managing sub trades, I think when you start managing your own sub trades, you'll realize how much value your builder, if they're a good builder, brings to that equation, and you end up, it's easy to end up over your head. But I guess some things you could look at doing yourself are maybe some of the finishes and the joinery and the things that aren't voiding your warranty. So if you do your own bathroom fit out and there's a bathroom leak, you're not covered. So you've done your own. Or you descend into a grey area where maybe the builder did the waterproofing. Your tiler has done the tiling, and who is responsible? Did your tiler damage the waterproofing, or was the waterproofing inadequate? So that just might be a little pitfall that you want to avoid. It's inevitably you do, if you want to do the work yourself, or at one extreme become, it's very easy and simple to become a DIY builder in terms of compliance. Anyway, you can get a builder's license. I think it's an online course that you do, and it only takes a matter of hours, and you can build your own house. So that's at the other extreme. But I think you just, my advice is, if you're going to do that, hire really good tradesmen who know what they're doing that can help you out, and particularly get the best, if you're taking that on, get the best roofer you can. Get really good window contractors that will install and flash windows. But I guess, I don't know, is it a strategy for cost saving long term? I don't know.
Well, it sounds like out of all the different stages, at the construction stage, there is a little bit more flexibility in terms of like what you could do yourself.
Oh, look,
versus
yeah.
It being really important to get professionals in to do a good job.
Oh, but just you can certainly get quotes for, you know, for particularly sundry things like blinds and focus on those things. Maybe leave them out of the building contract and done yourself. Like, yeah, I guess things that come to mind, potentially blinds, shower screens, maybe even aircon. Yeah, you can really, yeah, joinery, you can, you know, you might get the joinery installed that has plumbing and electricity in it, but then you might do your own wardrobes and leave some things out. And I guess the 1000th thing is just give yourself flexibility in the builds to adjust back. So there's things that are vital to you moving into your house and enjoying it, like window and roof. There's things that maybe you can leave out of the contract, like wardrobes, in some areas. But, you know, there's always a counter argument to say, hey, if you're going to bother getting a joiner, just get them to do everything, you know, and get it done. So it's done. Otherwise you're going to drag it out. Maybe you'll pay more down the track. for
yeah. So I guess it's more an individual circumstance sort of thing at the construction stage, just depending on where you're at. If you're someone who would prefer to get things done and you could afford to get it all done versus someone who really needs to stagger the process of finishing up the house, and that's an option here as well. Whereas in the previous stages, it's pretty much set in stone, and you know, these are the things that you really need to make sure are in place in order for the project to be successful down the line.
Yeah, so the thing you got to be careful of is that there's economy in getting everything done at the same time, because you're going to need a tradesman, you're going to need a site manager or someone who sets things out and manages a site. So there is less economy in staging work, definitely, but there's then a financial reality that you have that you can do and what you might defer for the future.
Yeah.
So you've got to weigh those things up, but I certainly would discourage, well, I wouldn't discourage, I'd probably just lay out sort of the facts from my perspective for clients who are kind of thinking, well, I don't want to spend that much. I might do something this year and something in 6 months' time. And you kind of go, well, if you have the means to borrow a bit more money now, it probably makes sense. There's a saving to be had by doing all the work together, as well as thinking about your mental health, you know. And the overall value created. I've done staged work. I guess it's a little bit different in my case because I can, you know, as a building company owner, I can move resources around, and when we're a bit quieter, I can put guys on to do a part of the job and then have that bit done. So it's a little bit different, but if you're an owner builder, if you're managing your own work, yeah, certainly it's a lot easier to stage things. You just get your mates over and on a weekend and offer, you know, a sausage sizzle and beers and get them to help you a little bit. Then it makes sense to stage things because you can get something built, you get a room built. Maybe we've done that. I've done that before. I'll share an interesting story. My mate helped me to install a roof once.
Yeah.
And we got, we just started, and he came down with a stomach bug, which turned out to be appendicitis. So he was in hospital, went to surgery. Oh. Meanwhile, I'm on the roof with these large sheets and just me. And then the wind sprung up.
Oh, no. That's not going to end well.
I couldn't find anyone else to help me quickly, but I'm there with these sheets that we just put up on the roof, and I'm like, I can't, and I'm just desperately trying to strap them down to stop them blowing away while quickly unstrapping, moving one at a time and securing it. So make sure you got, I guess the lesson there is make sure you have some redundancy in the system and plan ahead. But I got it done. It wasn't the best. It was totally good enough. It was large sheets, and I did it very hurriedly. I could have maybe done a better job, but I got the sheets done, and just got down before it got really, really, really windy. And the lesson there is make sure your mates are well if they're coming to help you, and make sure they can finish the job. And two is check the weather.
That sounds really basic, but yeah, it is important. I guess the overarching conclusion of all of this is to have really good planning, right? Like to be able to do as much as you can to foresee the pitfalls and just not walk into them.
So from the outset, understand the risks and the potential costs and the outcomes and listen to good advice from all of those people that we talked about, whether it's a designer or a planning solicitor or
your cost estimator
or quantity surveyor. Listen to the advice And take it on board. And if you're a skilled negotiator, or you're a skilled tradesman or a skilled builder, yeah, you might be able to move the dial on some of those things. But if you don't know a lot about building, then probably assuming that you're going to shift the dial on what the estimators come up with is probably a little bit naive, but
yeah,
it's possible, but
yeah,
it's unlikely. So yeah, that's one of the basic sort of recurring themes from today. Listen to advice.
All right, so that is a great conclusion as we come towards wrapping up our episode. So just before we head off, what is the main takeaways from today's episode?
So I think the main takeaways is, first and foremost, get advice, listen to that advice, and do your homework, do your research, and particularly in the planning stages. The second thing is try and really simplify and rationalize. If you want a cost-effective build, limit the number of materials, use off-the-shelf strategies or even off-the-shelf designs in terms of a project home. That'll really get the price down. And the third thing is quality of the design, and focuses on your objectives and delivers good quality documentation. Those are the three key things. I think that's the three strategies that I would use to get the price down if I was on a budget.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Matt. I think it's been a really informative episode, and it could really inspire, I guess, to get creative about how they can cut down on their building costs. And we'll talk again next episode.
Thanks, Jean.
Thanks.
Thank you. Have a great week.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning into Buildopedia. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a rating to help other listeners like you find our podcast. For more information, please check out the show notes and connect with us on social media. We would love to hear from you.